if I pushed all the correct buttons, even with the new server issues. I should have on the phone Chris Pandolfi. Can you hear me, Chris?
I can. How's it going?
It's going great. It's going great. I have to tell you this up front. I had the great opportunity to take this whole broadcasting pile of equipment with me to Gray Fox this year for the first time. And I'm broadcasting right alongside of the Gray Fox stage. There were two times, I will tell you this, there were two times I absolutely abandoned my post and left it all there for whoever wanted to abuse my microphone or my computer. It's the first time was when Charlie Cushman kicked off the Earls of Leicester. I got up and ran into the front of the fence. The second time was when the infamous String Dusters came out on stage, and I just abandoned my whole kit in the dark and ran around to the front of the stage. So, if that means anything at all.
Well, I appreciate that. No, great. Gray Fox has been. It's been cool to come back to Gray Fox over the past couple of years and kind of do our thing, because you know that festival, you know, has lots of different styles of bluegrass, but that's the first bluegrass festival I ever went to.
Is it really?
Gray Fox.
Just as a guy or as a performer or what?
Oh no, this was like I'd been playing banjo for, you know, probably a year. Didn't know anyone on the scene whatsoever. You know, knew some of the bands obviously, and went to Gray Fox with my college roommate, and we were vastly underprepared. It was our first festival, bluegrass or any festival at all. So, but we had a blast. He was my college roommate, Jeremy Robin, and he learned mandolin as I was learning banjo. I picked it up when I was 18, so I was a freshman in college, basically. And we went to Gray Fox and, you know, just had one of those very memorable moments where you are like, what is this thing, you know? And we were hooked. It was very memorable. So, like I say, it's been very cool to go back to Gray Fox.
That has to be such an open, welcome environment for what the String Dusters are doing right now, and because your music is so encompassing, I think. The musicianship is so solid to begin with, but I think that what the band is doing, and we can talk about this a little bit, but that was just really my confession, that I actually did leave my microphone when you guys started up. I've seen you before, but I just left abandoned it. But I would think Gray Fox is a perfect fit for the infamous String Dusters.
It really is. I mean, Gray Fox is a very cool festival, a very eclectic lineup. But, you know, one of the things that's really cool about Gray Fox is it's really, to me, the hub of Northeastern bluegrass, and has been for years. You know, there's a few kind of mainstays in that bluegrass scene, definitely the Cantab Lounge in Boston, where, you know, I was there every single Tuesday for all 3 years that I lived in Boston. And, you know, these were can't-miss events for anyone who was tuning into bluegrass and living in that region. So, you know, a lot of the cross-pollination of young people playing the different strains of bluegrass led to a lot of bands forming. You know, when the Dusters were forming, I was living right before the Dusters formed. I was living in Boston, and that was when Crooked Steel was getting their start.
Sure.
You know, and Casey Dreesen had just come out of Berkeley. So it was cool. It's a very fertile and eclectic scene. And that's always been the Northeast's take on bluegrass in a way. I think that they, like a lot of places, really appreciate the old stuff, but have always just been an outpost for people who are doing a twist on the old thing. And so it's been sort of embraced by default, and I think Gray Fox in a lot of ways kind of epitomizes that.
Well, I had known of, just, and the listeners know, the normal listeners, like there is such a thing. The regular listeners of this show know that Casey Dreesen's been on, talked about all those cool things. Rashad Eggleston's been on, sitting on a bench, looking out at the ocean up in the Northeast. And so I think the regular listeners get what you're talking about as far as that type of a person and what they're bringing to music and where they're taking it. So I think that's a good description of what the Northeast presents and how it does all kind of culminate very nicely into that whole Gray Fox scene, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, like Rashad and Casey, those are two great examples, because those guys are, I mean, they're out there, way out there, you know, I mean, very, very wide scope of musical influences. And, but at the same time, and I think that this is why they are ultimately embraced by the sort of acoustic scene at large, is just great musicians, unbelievable quality of musicianship. And to me, you know, that's always been underneath the sort of burning question of what is bluegrass and all its many forms and how to categorize them is the one real tie that binds for a lot of the music fans is just musicianship.
Yeah.
And quality of songs, quality of playing. And, you know, those guys are really, that's what they do. And, you know, I hope that's what, how people perceive the String Dusters. That's certainly sort of how we perceive ourselves. And it's a cool thing to be a part of, you know, quality music, branching out and building off of this base that is kind of so pure, so magical.
Were you classmates with either Casey or Rashad, or just in school around the same time, or what?
Casey finished right before me. That was right when Andy Hall finished. Actually, those guys had just moved down to Nashville.
Okay.
when I moved to Boston. And yeah, Rashad and I overlapped, I think, by one semester. You know, I got my undergrad degree at Dartmouth before I even enrolled at Berkeley. So I was, you know, just a year or so younger than those guys. Well, I'm 3 years younger than Andy Hall, but Rashad and I overlapped by a semester, and yeah, we would jam in the practice rooms, and you know, we would do pickup bands at the Can Tab, and so it was a very cool time to be in Boston.
Are you the first guy walking around with a degree in banjo?
I was the first banjo principal at the Berklee College of Music.
Uh-huh.
So you know, when I applied, Matt Glazer, Tony Trischka had been my banjo teacher, and I consulted with Tony when I wanted to go to music school.
Good,
you know,
choice.
Which really was for me just affording myself the opportunity, some more time to work on music and learn, and really wanted to go to Berklee. So Tony set me up with Matt, who's the chair of the strings department, and he helped to make it happen. So I was a banjo principal, but I would do my proficiencies with, you know, guitar teachers, because there was no banjo teacher. So they were, you know, the easiest way to describe it is they were teaching me more what to play and less how to play it. And then after I was done, it was a few years later that Roger Brown became the president of Berklee and came in with maybe a bit of a more modern vision, embraced the banjo right away, gave Earl Scruggs an honorary degree, and a year after that, there was a banjo and mandolin principal available on the application. So it's awesome to see what's going on. I've been back to do a little 3-day teaching residency, working
Great.
With all the banjo students, and they've got a really awesome program flourishing. So it's cool.
That's great. I mean, that, oh yeah, that's, I think, and here's the reason. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Chris Pandolfi, who's nice enough to be around on probably a beautiful Saturday out in, you're out in Colorado, right?
Yeah, snowing today.
Snowing. Oh, that's a shame in the mountains. Daggone it. We're talking to Chris. We're going to talk about the new album, Let It Go, and other stuff. But while we're talking about your banjo, your entry into the world, I play banjo for fun, all right, with friends, and we play out every once. But I describe myself as very pedestrian, which I think is generous in my own description. But I've had so many great players come on this show. Herb Peterson said it best to me. Said, Herb, let's talk about when you were learning. He says, I was a needle lifter, which was the best description of, you know, the guys used to pick the needle off the record and put it back down, and pick it up and put it back down, and learn that lick off of Earl or the Osmond Brothers or whatever, pick it up, put it back down. That's a great word for when Herb Peterson was learning and those guys. What was your introduction into, I don't know, were you playing vinyl? How were you picking it up?
No, my whole introduction to the banjo world came because my older brother is a bass player. So when, you know, I was in high school and he was early in college, he was a fan of Victor Wooten, and he turned me on to the Flecktones. And it was at a time when I was getting really into music at large, listening to all kinds of things, but nothing banjo, nothing bluegrass. And we started going to see these Flecktones shows, and you know, I don't know if I'll ever be quite, I hope I can, but the level of inspiration, I was just couldn't believe what I was seeing, you know, and I had no context. I had no preconceived notions of the music world or what it was to play music. I wasn't really a musician, but I was just like seeing this thing, the Flecktones. It was the ultimate blend of, you know, something so new, so unique, so deep, so real. I mean, the musicianship, again, just the quality, I couldn't believe it. and I went to see the Flecktones play. They played three nights, two shows a night, and a buddy of mine and I went to all six shows, and I bought my first banjo like 2 days later. And that was it. The banjo got me into bluegrass and not the other way around.
Okay.
So my path of learning has been somewhat backwards. You know, I started with the stuff that I was really into, the progressive stuff. And then years later, you know, I found my way all the way back to Earl. And, you know, once I finally kind of fell deeply in love with that stuff, after having been exposed to it, you know, learned a lot of that, and all still very much a work in progress for me. And I feel like I could really, you know, stand to ingest and polish so many more things. But Bela is really what got me into it, for sure.
And of course, Bela plays bluegrass when he wants to. Bela plays whatever he wants whenever he wants to. But when you're seeing the Flecktones, you're seeing a musical instrument in Bela's hands. It's a banjo, but you're not seeing a bluegrass style. You're seeing a musical instrument at the peak. So your first exposure was then to the instrument in the hands of Bela Fleck, what he was doing with the Flecktones, not with the bluegrass album, you know, stuff, the reunion stuff that he did and all. You're seeing the Flecktones. That's amazing to me that your first exposure to that instrument was strictly as an instrument in the hands of that performer. So that you really did have a kind of a sideways entry into the music itself.
Yeah, and I think it's weird, you know. I mean, obviously hindsight is 2020, but if I could do it all again, or if I was trying to explain to someone how to do it best, you know, that is learning banjo. You know, it's interesting because it took me a long time to learn. Like you say, when you see Bela, you know, you're not seeing bluegrass, but you are seeing someone who, and this is true of all great banjo players, you're seeing someone who has ingested bluegrass so, so deeply. And that was something, you know, just like I say, I didn't really learn Earl's stuff until I fell in love with it. But, you know, it wasn't until 6 or 7 years in playing banjo, then really at the advice of Ben Eldridge, I was living with Chris Eldridge at the time in Nashville, saying, you know, you need to learn, he said, you need to learn Scruggs style, because when you learn Scruggs, it puts all the more sort of progressive banjo ideas in context. And that was you know, like your Herb Peterson needle lifting comment, that for me was like just perfect. Like, if you learn Earl playing, it's not that you suddenly play like Earl all the time. It's just that his playing somehow outlined this perfect blueprint for the mechanics of the instrument. And even a guy like Bela, who's playing so progressively, is still drawing heavily on, you know, the lessons of Earl, the timing, the delivery, the tone. So yeah, it's learning bluegrass, even though it didn't come until later, was, I think, the most beneficial thing, and still something I work on all the time, just playing solidly, you know, playing with good right hand technique. And Bela has obviously those things nailed, and that all comes from bluegrass.
Well, and I want to get to what's current, but now that you've mentioned Earl, when you discovered Earl, how did you get, when Ben Eldridge tells you you got to learn Earl's basic, you know, all of his stuff, which is very, very difficult, as you're finding out. But how did you start learning at that 5 or 6 years into it? How did you approach Earl at that point?
Well, I will say the real gateway to Earl for me was Tom Adams. And I got a copy of Adams County Banjo, which, you know, it was like Earl with a twist. And then I was like, oh my God, it just absolutely floored me. And then I started listening to Foggy Mountain Banjo and Tis Sweet to Be Remembered and the Mercury Sessions. Those were sort of the three albums. And watching a lot of stuff on YouTube, the Martha White stuff.
Yeah.
I'd heard this stuff a million times. But what I started to do was to just learn it absolutely by ear, note for note, and play along with it just ad nauseum. Not approximate it, not learn it a little bit and then sort of put your own twist on it. Just take, you know, and of course I could do this for the rest of my life and probably continue to improve and still, like I say, work on this stuff all the time. But it was just getting deeper on it, just listening to it a million times and, you know, playing it just as closely to the recordings as I could. And that was sort of the change that was going on at that time.
You needed to get it in your soul.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. That's neat. Well, I see. This is. I knew these things were going to come up as we were talking because I knew that you got into it later. I didn't know all the details, but so now you've kind of come full circle. The guys you're talking to, when you talk to Tony Trischka about going to Berkeley or not, and that's, you know, Tony learned doing the old fashioned way and absorbing all of Earl's stuff and then all the other great players that were around that time. So you jumped off into the deep water with Bela. And then at some point realized through the help of Ben Eldridge that you needed to go back and just learn those, they're not basic things, that underlies the unbelievable genius that Earl had to say, oh, you got to go learn the basics. It's more than basics. It's the entire concept of playing the banjo with the timing and the right hand. So that's interesting that you kind of went back so much later and picked those things up. It's cool.
I wouldn't recommend that route to people, But you know, it's like I say, hindsight is 20/20, and that makes you the musician that you are ultimately. Some things take a little longer to figure out, but yeah, now these days I feel like I have a more complete picture of it all, and the old stuff is really where it's at.
Yeah, that's great. All right, now we know about the infamous String Dusters. I play some of your solo stuff on here often. And now the infamous String Dusters have a new album coming out, and I want to get to that. It comes out, what, April 1st, right? And that's not a joke.
That's right. That's correct. Not a joke.
And the new album is Let It Go?
Yep.
Okay. Do you want to talk about that now, or do you want to get anything else?
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about it a minute.
Well, yeah, it's coming out April 1st, new album. That's been just a long time in the making for us. I think that, for one thing, we're excited. We're proud of it, and the energy that comes from that, as far as, you know, your team and everything that's set up for this year. We have a lot of good energy behind this album, and I think for us as a band, it was just a big step forward creatively and aesthetically, because we found ourselves just asking, you know, why record? I think touring is what we do. It's what we've always done. You know, we tour. That's how our business operates. It's how we sustain ourselves. But you know, recording is something that every band does, and it just didn't come quite as naturally to us. I think that, you know, you spend so many days on the road, and then once every 2 years you jump in the studio, and you know, the pressure's on and the people aren't there, and so it took us a little while, but we did give a lot of thought to that question of why to record, and we worked really hard on a bunch of songs, and you know, just put our heart and soul into making something that will hopefully last. And I think it's a combination of a lot of factors that starts with the whole concept, and then it moves on to the songwriting, and then it moves on to, you know, executing in the studio and having a good team and getting it sound right. And we're just excited. We feel like a lot of things have changed for us over the last few years, and this is really the first album that has been conceptually from the ground up, just by the five of us.
That's a good point, because the very first album, you guys were like brand new to this and just kind of went in. You remember the very first one, the infamous String Dusters, and I think it was that the self-titled, the very first one?
Fork in the Road,
I'm sorry, yes, and that's the one that got all the attention right away. But you guys hadn't really had a chance, correct me if I'm wrong, to really live this experience. You've matured a lot over the years, but I think when that album came out, weren't you still pretty new to each other as far as, you know, really getting where you wanted to understand what you wanted to do and what you wanted to say through music?
Oh, yeah, and I mean, it took years, you know, before I was just kicked off a process, a many years process, that hopefully will always go on. I mean, I hope we'll always be evolving and spending time as a group trying to figure out, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? What do we want this to look like, to feel like? And, you know, that's our strength as a band, is we're just really lucky that the five of us are really consistent in what we want. And even though we do continue to evolve, I think that our goal, you know, the five of us, like I say, remain pretty in line, and that just helps us make decisions and figure out, you know, how do we want this music to sound? What do we want this show to look like? And with Let It Go, it was the most current iteration of that, the most thought out, I think the best conceived iteration of that. And so, you know, it's also been a long time since we recorded. And I think that hopefully that this is the first in a string of more meaningful albums that are, you know, first and foremost focused on songwriting, but, you know, are just the sound of this band and trying to continually just push what we can do creatively, aesthetically, and hopefully just, like I said, create something that will last.
Here's what I hear you saying, and let me cut through some of the words as I hear what you're saying, and maybe we don't want to say this, but I think that what the band is doing as they mature from that very first fork in the road thing, which was really kind of burst so quickly, and you've matured and you've grown, you've recorded, you've toured. I think that when you come to the studio, the String Dusters, the way you're describing, you become more focused on, I don't want to say making a statement, but you seem more purposeful. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I think we're going into the studio and now we're finally putting a real feeling into those recordings and not just trying to... Not just trying to not make mistakes, because a recording is a record. So, I mean, it's hard to go in the studio and, you know, and that's the X factor of music or art in general is does it have that intangible quality behind it that, you know, no one has the answer to why millions of people relate to one song over another, but you got to believe that it has everything to do with that kind of mojo factor. So capturing that in the studio is a hard thing, and I think that hopefully that's what we're starting to do.
And I think you're all very confident in wherever this process is taking you as you mature. You are going to go where it goes. In other words, you're not going to be bound by convention or somebody else's description of where you should or shouldn't go in your music. I think you're confident enough now with the track record that you have to go into the studio to make a statement about the music you're doing, but also to make a statement about what you are and what you're doing, correct?
Yeah, and that's the cool, absolutely. And that's the cool thing about being in a band like this. You know, from the very beginning we were our own entity and we had the vision and everything. It just came from the five of us. So unlike a lot of other bands that are, you know, sort of a lottery ticket in a sea of radio plays and a much more sort of unknown equation, I feel like we know what we are. We have this great solid fan base that supports us. Of course we hope to grow a ton, but you know, we make the music that we want to make. We're not trying to necessarily conform to anything. We're just trying to do the best version of what we can be, and that artistic freedom, you know, we're starting to realize more and more as our career goes along just how awesome, how valuable that
is. Well, it's incredible, and you guys do a great job at doing it. And let me make this statement for you too. Not only do you not want to conform, you can if you want to, but you also don't think that you have to be, you aren't the leading edge of trite word, you're not the leading edge of a revolution. You're just making the music that you feel is appropriate. You're not trying to say follow us, you're just trying to say this is what we're doing and where we want to go. You're not trying to relabel or remake any type of genre of music. I hate the word genre because I think it limits, but I think you're not trying to conform. You're not trying to say, follow us to the new ground. You're just trying to say, we're a band. We have members, the infamous String Dusters. This is our music.
Yeah, I mean, that's all you can do. Yeah. I think to get caught up in anything else is to take your eyes off that, the artistic goal, that creative goal that requires all your attention. You know, as you're career rolls along for us, especially, it feels like the goal is just to make it so that we, the five of us, can just focus on the music. And if we can be freed up to do that and, you know, put our best foot forward in that realm, then that'll be our greatest asset. That'll become the most important thing we've got going for us. So it's, you know, that's sort of the goal
on this new Let It Go album, which will come out a month. Are there particular tunes? First of all, I've not seen any of the liner notes for it yet, and I know it's going to come out. I probably could have researched that as to who wrote what and where. But did you contribute to writing any of the tunes?
Yeah, I did actually. I contributed more writing on this record than any previous record. You know, I'm the only one out of the five of us who, you know, I'll sing lead on a song once in a blue moon. But for the most part, you know, I'm playing the banjo, singing a few harmony parts. So
you're carrying on the proud tradition. You're carrying on the proud tradition of banjo players.
That's right. But for songwriting, the rest of the guys, obviously, they're all singers, so they're all contributing songs. Now, for this album, I had some more kind of co-writing, you know, having instrumental interludes in the middle of songs, some things that I had written ahead of time that ended up just sort of working into songs as we were doing pre-production sessions. But, you know, we share all writing credits on all songs that go on String Duster's album. So, you know, usually you can decipher who's sort of the lead writer based on who's singing. But yeah, it's something that we've been doing for the last two albums, just sharing all the writing credits. So it's a very much a team effort. And,
oh, cool.
You know, that's like one more piece in the sort of bigger equation of just trying to make the best art, is removing the pressure of, is my song going to be on the album?
You're taking the ego out of it. You're taking the ego out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to just take the stuff that's best. And, you know, there's so many things that go into making a band go that, why should songwriting, which is this one piece, albeit invaluable piece, but just this one piece of a much bigger puzzle, why should it carry such a disproportionate weight with, you know, the old school notion of just only the songwriter gets paid? So it's a very much a team effort. We do a lot of our pre-production together, but, you know, in some ways, it's a collection of songs. It's a collection of songs that are kind of the latest and greatest. I've contributed a bunch of stuff. There is one straight up instrumental on there called Middle Fork, which is a recent banjo creation that came out great, just like a lot of other things. It has a very organic feel, and it just really represents, I think, what our band has become through all these years of touring. So
I love you keep coming back to that, because I remember you guys when you started out. I saw you when you first hit the stage, and within a few months, and a lot of people did. I'm not saying special by that, but I love the fact that now that these years have gone by, and you keep coming back to we, and we're growing and what we want to do. And that's amazing for a band, because so many bands have, and there's nothing wrong with it. So many bands have a name, but the players are, you know, who's with you this month or something. You guys really, for the most part, I know you had a recent change, but for the most part, you're still in that same, you know, we are the infamous String Dusters, and we're still in this creating and finding ourselves. And it's just kind of neat that you keep coming back to that. I think that's refreshing, at least.
Well, that's, like I say, that's just,
and it works.
That's kind of what we're all about.
Yeah.
And we're lucky. We try really not to take that for granted. And we try to, you know, and take advantage of, like I say, the strength in the consistency of knowing that, you know, this group of people who are all, in many ways, I mean, we, you know, when you look at like guys' solo projects, we have people ranging all over the map, but, you know, there's a great mutual respect, and, you know, we've learned how to work together to that end, and just realize that when you are unified, you know, it really can work in your favor.
That's neat. There's a portion of the proceeds of Let It Go when it's sold go to the Conservation Alliance. And I want you to speak Alliance. I want you to speak about that for a minute.
You know, the Conservation Alliance, you know, I'm sure many people don't know what they're all about, but they're a great group. They've been around for years, founded by some really notable outdoor brands, Patagonia, the North Face, and a few others, to funnel dollars from responsible business, basically into grassroots conservation action all over the country. You know, their annual budget is millions of dollars, so they're able to make a real impact and have a great reputation because of some of those branding alliances. And we, the band, you know, we have a lot of ties to conservation, the environment. I was an environmental studies major in college. My dad was a conservationist. You know,
okay.
Travis was a professional mountain biker. We're all skiers, outdoor enthusiasts. I worked as a fly fishing guide before I was a banjo player. So there are all these ties to the great outdoors, and we found ourselves doing all these things, connecting with fans via this common thread. And as we sought sponsors in the outdoor world, people who were teamed up with now, like Clean Canteen and Offspray and a few other brands, it made a lot of sense to bring a nonprofit organization on board, because you know, it just gives us a chance to, when we go out and tour, now if you've been doing this for years and, you know, you're not riding around in stretch limousines, you know, it helps to make the touring about something more than just, you know, look at us, we're playing music, how much more popular can we get? Because, you know, that's of course part of the equation, because we want to be able to do this for a long time and we love it and people really enjoy the art. But, you know, you still have 365 days in a year, you're traveling all over, you're reaching all these people. So we decided to take that, you know, as our fan base grows, that kind of growing mouthpiece, and try to do some good with it. So we gave $1 from every ticket sold from the last two tours to the Oscar Blues Candidate Foundation, which they're helping flood relief in the Front Range after those awful floods last fall, winter in the Boulder area. Because I live in Denver and Andy Hall lives in Lyons. And now we're working with the Conservation Alliance and hopefully promoting what they do and giving money to grassroots environmental efforts all over the place. So it's
kind
of cool.
That's a great, because you're an outdoor enthusiast. So you feel like through your work, then, you know, as you're skiing or whatever you choose to do, you're contributing to preserving those things around you in that way by doing that contribution. That's a great idea.
Yeah, and you know, and it also helps us reach people, and we want that too. And we want to find more fans. We want to connect more people. You know, the community that's forming around our music is one of the most meaningful aspects, I think, of the career. You know, bringing people together who wouldn't have been connected before just because of your music. I mean, that's a heavy thing when the community starts to organize unto themselves. So this is one more outlet to reach people. And, you know, we're not trying to hide that. It's not all just giving money to the environment. You know, it's a way for us to help them and for them to help us.
Well, sure.
Hopefully to have a bigger reach for everyone.
Yeah, it's great. This is great. I'm enjoying this. The new album comes out April 1st. You guys are very busy touring-wise, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation. You do that. You like to do that. The recording is kind of a, let's go do some stuff, but you guys live on the road and you have a very busy touring schedule, and they can follow the String Dusters. You have a very active website, I have to say, and find out where you're going there.
Yeah, no, tell me about it. I just got off the bus and I'm almost, my laundry's done and now I got to start thinking about packing to get back on, but it's fun. We, you know, we enjoy touring, and right now, yeah, it certainly is the bread and butter of our operations. So we got a big tour coming up.
Yeah.
Around the CD release, and we're going to be everywhere.
Cool. Well, I mean, yeah. If you go to just Google Infamous String Dusters, you'll find what he's talking about, and you'll see that when the thing hits, you guys are everywhere. You're just everywhere, and which is great, because then you get to get behind the album. I assume you'll be playing a lot of stuff from the new album. Of course, you have a pretty good library to pull from anyway, but you'll be out behind this album, which will be a blast. I can't wait to hear it and get it worked into the show, and this has been great, man. Listen, I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're busy, and this has been fun. I've enjoyed getting a little bit more about the band, and I was suspicious of some things about your education as far as the music end, but you've helped clarify a lot of things for me, and I think for the people listening, and I happen to think this is a pretty cool audience, so I know they appreciate it.
Cool. Well, thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
And, yeah, definitely enjoyed speaking as well.
Good. Well, listen, we will we'll do this again sometime.
Absolutely. Sounds great. Thanks very much.
All right, Chris, take it easy, man.
All right. Take care.
That was good. You know, I knew some things about Chris, as everybody does. Not like I have any secret thing. I can read like everybody, but I learned things from that, which is really the point of doing this for me. I hope that you get to pick up some information or just get a different feel for the individuals behind the music. To me, it helps me personally connect to what they're doing if I have the opportunity to speak, not just me, but if I have a chance to hear them. I'm not a part of it, but I have a chance to actually hear them talk about what's in their heart and soul and what they want to do music-wise. And busy man. Thanks, Chris Pandolfi from the Infamous String Dusters.